This podcast delves into the dark, the depraved, and all things to keep you up at night. Listener discretion is advised. Now, sit back, pull the covers over your head, and allow yourself to be taken on a journey through the abyss.
In the alleyways of London, the Ripper hides from sight, patiently awaiting the ladies of the night. Catherine Eddowes, a Whitechapel whore, is standing in the lamplight, hoping she can score. The streets are all empty, so she starts to walk on home, passing the evil Ripper, who sees that she's alone. Emerging from the shadows, he pulls her to the ground. Her mouth is muffled in his hand, she cannot make a sound. He draws a savage dagger from underneath his coat, and showing her no mercy, he swiftly cuts her throat. He shifts her to the shadows and removes her underwear. He rips her private places and leaves the body there. Then, like an apparition, he disappears unseen, the most notorious killer that there has ever been.
What's up there, pod people? Welcome to Through the Abyss podcast. I'm your co-host, Mandy.
And I am the fabulous Bane.
With a huge beard mountain man thing going on here.
Yeah, I've been oiling it and stuff. I'm trying to thank you. I've actually been putting oil and stuff on. It's actually, instead of just I haven't shaved, which, because I can grow a beard, which is fortunate and unfortunate, in a week. This is no, I'm actually catering to it.
Oh my God. You're jumping back into the 1800s. Is it because we're doing Jack the Ripper that you're trying to emulate?
No.
The 1800s mustachery.
No, when I got sick, I didn't shave, and then I was let's just kind of maintain it. So I just started taking care of it.
Oh my gosh, I love it. I love it. I'm sure our 1800s London people will love it too.
Yeah.
All right. So today we are jumping back into our Jack the Ripper series. We are on part 4, which is his fourth victim, Catherine Eddowes. And she was born April 14th, 1842, in Graisley Green, Wolverhampton. Her father was George Eddowes. Her mother was Catherine Nee Evans. She has two sisters, or I guess I should say had, Elizabeth Fisher and Eliza Gold, which obviously they're married names. And she also had an uncle named William Eddowes. Her father and his brother William left their jobs as tinplate workers in Wolverhampton during the Tinsmen strike about 1848. And this is when they all moved to London. I love that name, Wolverhampton. I want to live there just because of the name. In the early 1860s, Catherine returned to Wolverhampton to visit her family. Her relatives recalled the visit and described her as a very good looking and jolly sort of girl. It
got the relative approval. They're like, she's a good looking lady. She's always nice. To try and sell her to somebody.
She'd be perfect for prostitution.
Oh, Lord.
I like how they, it's just, it really surprises me, you know, because you're thinking 1800s and no internet, no computers, no nothing like that. And all these people, when they're going through doing their investigation, they're finding their relatives who aren't even immediate relatives. I just find that fascinating.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's actually true or not. Or if they're just stuff in there to fill out their depositions.
I think it's curious. I'm about to say things that are going to get me judged. Maybe I should hold off. But no, I'm going to say it. But the pictures, right? They're saying her family says she was a good-looking girl. And then the last victim, obviously, seemed to be very, very good at picking up men. But for me, it's you look at these old photos. Photos though, and I don't know if it's just that beauty standards have changed or if the photos are just terrible because cameras sucked, but it's I haven't seen a pretty one yet. I'm just going to put that out there.
Well, I'd say it's probably photo quality.
Probably photo quality, yeah.
Some are, you know, terrible, grainy, black and white photos or sketches. But, right. Time period, too, because they don't have the same grooming habits, I should say, as women do today.
Right. Maybe. Well, and body standards and makeup and things like that. Obviously, all of that was different back then, too.
Well, but also I think for back me, then, it's, go ahead.
What was that? Oh, I was go just going to say for me too, like it, if you put a picture of a woman right beside a picture of a mutilated woman and they're the same woman, like any sort of like, that's all gone, right? Like, so, and unfortunately for the Jack the Ripper victims, you, when you look them up, you're going to see them mutilated as well. Right. So,
and
it's not real attractive.
Yeah, and listeners, I actually have, on our outlines that we use, I have
included
a regular picture and two of her postmortem
pictures.
I'm
just staring at those, yes.
Well, you know, you got to get the full effect, right?
Mm.
And I told you, I don't know why it's morbid and creepy, but I love crime scene photos. It's just, it's so fascinating to me. I don't know. It's weird. I could be crazy.
It is weird. I mean, if you like them because you're looking for clues and things like that, that's understandable, like a puzzle. But if you're just like, I just really like looking at this picture of this mutilated person in this torn up room, I'm not saying you're weird, I'm saying I don't get it.
That's not really the gore, I think it's more of an anatomical fascination, I think.
Okay.
I
mean, for me, I'm squeamish.
I was
you know
a paramedic, so I kind
of
like
right?
it.
Like, I can't see any of that stuff, so I'm...
Well, now I don't know how I would be in person.
Yeah.
You know, because I've...
And then you're incorporating smell.
Oh God, yeah, and that's oh Lord, that was one thing that I had a problem with, like in the ambulance when people would vomit. Oh, Mandy about lost her shit every time.
Yeah, no good.
All right, where were we? We totally got off on track again. That's okay.
Yes,
that's okay.
We were okay. Wolverhampton.
Wolverhampton. She moved back to Wolverhampton. Oh yeah, the jolly sort of looking. Okay, here we go. Catherine is educated at St. John's Charity School, Pottersfield, Tooley Street, until her mother dies in 1855, when most of her siblings entered Bermondsey Workhouse and Industrial School. There's another workhouse.
Yeah.
I hate that for them. I'm assuming they're like orphanages in some sense, because I mean, they've got their kids.
Yeah, it says for school, it's kind of like a boarding house.
A boarding school type thing. Interesting. Her education continues when she returns to the care of her aunt in Bison Street, Wolverhampton. She attends Dowgate Charity School. By 1861-63, she leaves home with Thomas Conway. There's no evidence to suggest that she and Conway were ever married. As a couple, they had three children. Annie, who was born in 1865, later Annie Phillips, when she got married, of course, George, born around 1868, and another son born around 1873. Now, Conway and Edo split in 1881, with Kate as in, you know, Catherine, taking Annie and Conway, the boy. 1881, Catherine moved to Cooney's Lodging House.
Ooh.
Yeah, and she met John Kelly. Kelly jobbed around the markets, but had been more or less regularly employed by a fruit salesman named Lander. Somewhere in this period, Catherine's daughter Annie marries Louis Phillips and begins to move around the Bermondsey and Southwark to avoid her mother's scrounging. So she was not a happy camper when it came to Mama, who was just trying to provide the best life for her in a bad part of town. Frederick Wilkinson, deputy at Cooney's, says Catherine was not often in drink and was a very jolly woman, often singing.
Oh my gosh, we have a non-drinker.
Oh my God.
Well, who is not, well,
not often.
Not all day. Yes.
Or perhaps he's just trying to not tread upon the dead.
Yes.
Which we will soon find out later.
Her family also said jolly, so they really like this jolly word.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, she must have been very pleasant to be around.
A jovial lady.
Still, there's such an awful part of town.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Yeah, I mean, and she's not surviving through alcohol, right? And she still has good spirits. So
yeah, that's
different than Chapman, right? Where Chapman was drunk all day and happy. That kind of is synonymous sometimes.
Yeah, that's... It's interesting, just, you know, how people... Well, I mean, I guess if her upbringing was basically the same as how she's living then, she probably didn't know any better, didn't know that it, you know, could be better elsewhere, I guess. I'm just obviously have no idea, but just have to throw out speculation. Now, she was generally in the lodging house for the night between 9 and 10, so she's an early girl, which is smart. He says she wasn't in the habit of walking the streets, and he'd never heard or seen her being intimate with anyone other than Kelly. Kelly himself claimed no knowledge of her ever walking the streets. He says that she sometimes drank to excess, but wasn't in the habit. Another sister, Eliza Gold, said that Catherine was of sober habits. Okay, so she wasn't a prostitute full time then, from what I'm gathering here, right?
Right, or maybe not even at all.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like it.
What I'm thinking is, this is obviously the night of the double event, right? So he's just made an attack. He didn't get to do it to fruition because he was startled by people that approached, right? So where his last victim was a prostitute by design, he kind of just grabbed whoever was there for Edo's. Which so is, I mean, not that a prostitute deserves any worse than anyone else, but this is someone who's just out there minding their own business and doesn't even fit his MO. So it's like even more sad because it's like someone he normally wouldn't have picked. It was just freak luck or lack of luck.
Like definitely lack of luck for her, that's for sure. That's horrible. Especially since she's one of those people who was inside between 9 and 10.
Yeah.
She had to pick the night to be out late. Let's jump into the murder timelines. Now we're Saturday and Sunday, September 29th through the 30th. At 8 a.m. on September 29th, she returns to Cooney's lodging house and sees Kelly. She's been turned out of the casual ward for some unspecified trouble. Kelly decides to pawn a pair of boots he had. He does this with a pawnbroker named Jones in Church Street. It was Kate who took them into the shop and pledged them under the name of Jane Kelly. She receives, okay, now it's written as 2/6. So I'm going to go off into a little tangent here because we actually had a conversation about this, I think on the first one, because we had no idea what the British equivalent's currency was.
Yeah.
I actually have one of my British friends, John. He's the one who actually does our main intro. He emailed me or Facebook messaged me a couple, well, it was last week, I think, and was talking about what this is. So like the 6D that was on the other ones that we had, that would be read as 6 pence. So I guess D is pence. Yeah.
Okay.
What the hell this is, I don't know. It's like 2/6. So 2 would be tuppence and the 6 would be 6 pence. So maybe 2 tuppence and 6 pence for boots. That's how I'm going to read it. Again, John, if you're listening, come back and explain this to me.
Instruction.
The writing has messed us up yet again. So we need some more clarification on that. But thank you for the previous clarification. It was fantastic. So it wasn't farthings, it's pence. So we were wrong. That's okay. Thank God I have friends who study all kinds of crazy stuff. I love it. We're going to go with tuppence and 6 pence for the boots. And she and Kelly take the money. They buy some food, tea, and sugar. So smart, good. Between 10 and 11 a.m., they were seen by Frederick Wilkinson eating breakfast in the lodging house kitchen. The information that I found is really, really fascinating. It's just it's so crazy to me that it's so thorough.
Yeah,
like all of these people can recall.
They know what she was eating breakfast that morning.
Yeah, they know what she bought with the money they did for the pawn boots and how much. It's just, I mean, I guess if everything was done, you know, quickly after it happened, that people could recall it. Or like I said, I think on a previous episode, maybe they're just wanting their 15 minutes of fame in the deposition. Because, I mean, it was it was a big investigation.
I do want to point out, something that popped in my head earlier. I know we've gone over the alcohol issue of that time period a lot, but just the fact that every, like, multiple people now have said that she doesn't drink.
Yeah.
Really shows you the alcohol problem of that time period. Because if I was talking about you, mm-hmm. whether or not you drank alcohol would never be part of the description. But everyone yeah. that talks about this lady is like, oh, by the way, she doesn't drink or doesn't drink much. Means that yeah. it's a significant factor during that time period, right?
Oh, yeah, because they talk about it for all of them.
Right.
You know, the others were like...
We know the drinking habits of every victim.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so that, yeah, I mean, it had to... Well, you know, too, London's cold, you know, during that the seasons and everything. So
yeah.
get you a good shot of whiskey, get warmed up on the inside a little bit, I guess. Right. I don't know. Or just, you know, dealing with your piss poor life. I don't know. But yeah, it's that definitely says something about the era and the place that they were living that
yeah, for sure.
alcohol is a factor in how you define somebody.
Yeah, it's like part of the culture.
It's a big part of the culture. It's like top of the list of the culture. That and, you know, maiming, killing, and robbing.
And living in a lodging house.
Yeah. Or, you know, renting a bed in a lodging house, we should say.
Right, right.
Oh, gosh, those people. Oh, I can't even imagine. All right. So by the afternoon, and this is still Saturday, the 29th, they were, again, without money. Etta says she's going to see if she can get some money from her daughter in Bermondsey. She parts with Kelly at 2 p.m., promising to be back no later than 4 p.m. Now, 8 p.m. rolls around. City PC Louis Robinson comes across Edo surrounded by a crowd outside 29 Aldgate High Street. She's very drunk and laying in a heap on the pavement. Robinson asked those in the crowd if anyone knew her. Nobody replied. He pulled her up to her feet and leaned her against the building shutters, but she slipped sideways. With the aid of City PC 959 George Simmons, they brought her to Bishopsgate Police Station. Louis Robinson, City Police Constable 931, said at Kate's inquest, on 29th at 8:30, I was on duty in Aldgate High Street. I saw a crowd of persons outside number 29. I saw there a woman who I have since recognized as a deceased lying on the footway drunk. I asked if there was one that knew her or knew where she lived, but I got no answer. Okay, so she's drunk.
Yeah.
Wondering what led her to that point. Especially since she needed money. Maybe because she has kind of a estranged relationship with her daughter. Maybe that kind of just depressed her and set her off.
Maybe.
Because she did go see her to get money. Which apparently she got money because she was drinking.
Right. Or well, yeah, it's early in the day. Right? It's only like 8:45.
Well, it's 8 p.m. Well, she goes to see her at 4, so between 4 and 8 is when she met with her daughter.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the time because in my mind shows that like maybe she's not normally a prostitute, but to accomplish that goal because she needed money, she got super drunk. But it's also super early in the day to really, I don't know. I don't know what the time period was back then of like when people used that service, but it seems like for most of the Ripper victims, right, that's in the a.m.
Not necessarily, because I mean, you think the Ripper victims, they were all going out that one last time to get money for their bedding.
Right.
So, you know, I'd say they probably worked whenever they could. So maybe you're right. Maybe she was doing the alcohol so that she could do that to get more money. That's a very good theory.
Hard to know, really. But
because I mean, honestly, I have a feeling that, you know, Whitechapel, if you see two people screwing in an alley, you just walk on by because it's part of regular everyday life, I would imagine.
If this was closer to the time of murder, I actually was thinking that, you know, I mean, people clearly pull the Bill Cosby, right? You mean she could be drugged or, you know, like she might, because we've got multiple people saying she hardly ever drinks and now she's laying on the ground. I mean, it's just very, very much out of character. You don't go from I never drink to, oh, now I'm like shit faced sleeping on the pavement pretty much in the middle of the day.
Right. Well, in the evening, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Oh, to be a fly on the wall on some of these things. I would just love to see how these people interact. from an anthropological standpoint, I think it would be interesting. Yeah. Now, at 8:45 p.m., Bishopsgate Police Station Sergeant James Byfield notes Eddowes' arrival at the station. Supported by PCs Robinson and Simmons, Eddowes was asked her name and she replied nothing. Oh, that's interesting. 8:50 p.m., PC Robinson looked in on her in her cell. She was asleep and smelled of alcohol, of course. At 9:45 p.m., the Gaylor City PC 968 George Hutt took charge of the prisoners. He visited the cell every half hour during the night upon the directive of Sergeant Byfield. At 9:45 p.m., the city PCs on night beat leave Bishopsgate Station. They're marched behind their beat sergeants from Bishopsgate Station to their respective beats. And amongst these men were city PCs Edward Watkins and James Harvey. Okay, so everybody's out and about now. And from what I gather, she's still in jail, right?
Yeah, it seems like.
Yeah. So approximately 10 p.m., City PC 881 Edward Watkins commenced his first full round of his beat. This consisted of Duke Street through Hinnage Lane, through a portion of Berry Street, then through Creech Church Lane into Leadenhall Street. Man, I wish I knew how the hell these people found this information, because I'd like to know. Eventually ended up in the Mitre Street. Whitechapel can't be that big because this dude is all over the place. He's like, I guess got like a 10 block beat from what I'm reading here. Looks like.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe there's streets that are crossing in between the block. Well, that's not really a thing, huh? The block is the street.
The block is the
I do think it's fascinating what you were saying earlier about how they get this information. It's like, do you think that Scotland Yard like saves the records of the beats like this long ago?
They might have. I mean, it's very possible.
Yeah. I mean, or, I imagine, you know, that's where it would had to have come from, is that this is his normal beat and it was just on file.
Or, you know, you got these scholars, because I mean, a lot of people have done dissertations on this case. So, I mean,
right.
Maybe these people are getting maps from the 1880s and just, you know, they've got some kind of information as to, you know, how many blocks or whatever that these cops had to walk, and just kind of maybe figured it out that way. Or, I mean, again, like you said, they could have kept that information. I mean,
yeah, I honestly feel that that's the best option, is that Scotland Yard keeps the information.
I would think so, because I mean, when I was doing tours at Bobby Mackey's, they've got a bunch of boxes in the basement that's got paperwork in it, and you know, of course, we went snooping. They had handwritten ledgers of when it was the Latin Quarter.
Yeah,
so that was, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s. Obviously, not as far back, but they had ledgers of when people called off sick. So, you know, the mob's keeping call offs. Yeah, wow. Maybe the cops are keeping the beats that are walked by the cops. So I don't know. It's interesting, but yeah, I would love to find out their research into this.
Yeah.
Now let's see. Still around 10 p.m. City PC 964 James Harvey commenced his beat, and again honestly, it's about the same as Watkins. If you look at all the streets, you got
Some similar same streets.
Yeah, Duke to Church to Aldgate, Mitre. It looks like they all kind of ended at Mitre and then wrapped back around.
Yeah.
So it couldn't have been that big then. 12:15 a.m. Kate, awake now, is heard singing softly to herself in the cell. At 12:30 a.m., she calls out to ask when she'll be released. And then the guard on duty, Hutt, replies, "When you're capable of taking care of yourself." She insists that she's able to do that now. At 12:55 a.m., Sergeant Byfield instructs PC Hutt to see if any prisoners were fit to be released. Kate was found to be sober. She gives her name as Mary Ann Kelly and her address as 6 Fashion Street, and she is released. Okay. It would have been so different if she had just passed out drunk for the night. Okay, so this is something that I guess not a lot of people have equated, you know, Mary Ann Kelly and Catherine Eddowes as knowing each other.
Right.
But, yeah. I mean, they have John Kelly in common.
Right, right. It's just, it feels very much like the killer had to have been someone that was associated with both of them. So it almost makes it more like, instead of Jack the Ripper just killing random prostitutes, he was killing people he knew. Not necessarily. It could have been random. I mean, the same prostitutes were probably out on the same streets every night, right? And they all hung out in similar locations. But it does seem like there's a possibility that he knew these people. Especially, you know, when we get to Marianne Kelly, since she's found inside of her home.
Or he perhaps knew just Catherine and Mary.
Maybe, right.
Or yeah, maybe he had a beef with John Kelly and was like, well, I'm going to kill your wife and your buddy.
Kill everyone you know.
Because, I mean, you know, Kate wasn't a prostitute. Or not Kate. Yeah, Kate wasn't a prostitute. So.
Right.
But Mary was. Yeah, it's definitely. Ooh, maybe the Ripper was John Kelly.
I mean, I think he is one of the suspects for sure.
Well, if that's the case, and he's stupid because you don't kill people, you know.
Right. And if that was you, it feels like if John Kelly was actually Jack the Ripper, he would have been caught.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. And I mean, John Kelly is kind of a regular name for now, but I mean, back then, I don't know. Could there have been multiple John Kellys? Because it's just,
I don't know.
I think it has to be the same guy. It's too coincidental that she gives his wife's name.
Right. And like I said, the forum I was looking at was saying that a lot of people think that she just used that as an alias.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really, really hard to believe that she randomly uses an alias that is the next victim.
Right. Which makes me think, I wonder if she liked this person. She's given another woman's name to the cops. So
yeah,
she obviously doesn't want to be on record as who she is.
Right, right.
So they may have some beef. I don't know. Oh, Kate, you should have just stayed drunk and slept in. Oh my God.
Yeah, stayed in prison. Would have been the right thing to do. Be like, you know what? I'm just going to sleep.
Oh gosh. Now, the website that I got this next part off of, it actually talks about what they said to each other, the police officer Hutt and Kate, which I don't know. It's I don't know how in the world you would remember. But so basically she leaves the station at 1 a.m. She asks Hutt what time it was, and he replies, it's too late for you to get anything to drink. And she says, I shall get a damn fine hiding when I get home, she tells him. Hutt replies, and serves you right. You had no right to get drunk. And pushes open the swinging door of the station, tells her, come on, please pull it too. And she's like, all right, good night, old cock. That's weird too. That's I guess old.
Yeah. You know, I've seen that written in other, in like old novels and stuff. It's kind of just a bizarre phrase. Yeah.
Yeah, it is just a little bit, but yeah, I don't know if I'm going to throw a little bit of shade on that. I don't know if they're just putting that in for entertainment value or not, but I don't know. Then again, they could have that very conversation.
Well, I mean, we know what the lady had for breakfast, so
this is true. This is true. So, you know, maybe Hutt went as soon as he found out she was dead. She's like, oh, I better write this conversation down.
I just feel he's really judgmental, man. It's like, I mean, yes, she shouldn't be publicly intoxicated laying on the ground, right? But you had no right to get drunk. I mean, I'm not even a drinker, but I support everyone else's right to get drunk when they want to.
Exactly. I'm right there with you. Oh my gosh. And that's one of those stereotypical, never mind, I'm not going to go there. So she turned and left out the doorway, which it took her in the opposite direction of what you would have been the fastest way back to where she was staying. It appears she was heading back towards Aldgate High Street, where she'd become drunk. Okay. On going down Houndsditch, she would have passed the entrance to Duke Street, at the end of which was Church Passage, which led into Mitre Square. It's estimated that it would have taken less than 10 minutes to reach Mitre Square, which leaves a 30-minute gap from the time she leaves the police station to the time she is seen outside of Mitre Square. Okay, 30 minutes. Okay. 1:35 a.m., Joseph Lawland, who's a commercial traveler, Joseph Chaim Levy, a butcher, and Harry Harris, a furniture dealer, leave the Imperial Club. At the corner of Duke Street and Church, they see Eddowes and a man talking. She's standing facing the man with her hand on his chest, but not in a manner to suggest that she's resisting him. Lawland describes the man as 30 years old, 5'7" tall, fair complexion, and mustache with a medium build. He's wearing a pepper and salt colored jacket, which fits loosely, a gray cloth cap with a peak of the same color. So there's another weird hat. He has a reddish handkerchief knotted around his neck. Overall, he gives the appearance of being a sailor. And Lawn will later identify Catherine Eddowes' clothes as the same as those worn by the woman he saw that night.
So his description here is very similar to the past descriptions we've gotten, right? We've definitely had in the 30s. We've definitely had that he was shorter.
Yep.
About 5'7". And then we've had the sailor hat before, right? So
yeah, yeah. And mustache.
Yes, the mustache, right, yeah.
Which probably describes 90% of the population, but that's okay. That's okay. But yeah, the hats and everything are...
Even the fair complexion, because they said at one point, someone had, his mustache was like sandy blonde.
Or his eyelashes were sandy
blonde. Eyelashes, right.
Yeah. Which would denote he's probably a ginger of some sort with you know, skin like mine. It's almost transparent or translucent. Now, approximately 1:45 p.m. the next day, that's a long ass time. I wonder if that's a typo. PC Edward Watkins discovers Eddowes' body in Mitre Square. Yeah, that has to be, it has to be a.m. Because there's no way in hell that they could go 12 hours without somebody noticing her.
No, it's 15 minutes.
Yeah, later. Okay, so that's just a typo, my bad. 1:45 a.m., her body's discovered. Okay, kids, we're getting into the postmortem part of this, and I'm going to be reading verbatim what Dr. Frederick Gordon Brown's, his postmortem notes are, and they're not exactly, they're not pretty. It's not dinner conversation, so if you get squeamish, now would be a good time to look the other way.
All right, I'll be looking.
Or, you know, fast forward. Oh, Ben, come now. All right. So, Dr. Frederick Gordon Brown, London police surgeon called in at the murder, arrived at Mitre Square around 2 a.m. His report is as follows. The body was on its back, the head turned to left shoulder, the arms by the side of the body as if they had fallen there, both palms upward, the fingers slightly bent. The left leg extended in a line with the body. The abdomen was exposed. Right leg bent at the thigh and knee. The throat cut across. So that's his trademark move, apparently.
Yeah.
The intestines were drawn out to a large extent and placed over the right shoulder.
Wow.
They were smeared over with some feculent matter. Good Lord, Jack. A piece of about 2 feet was quite detached from the body and placed between the body and the left arm, apparently by design. The lobe and auricle of the right ear were cut obliquely through. There was a quantity of clotted blood on the pavement on the left side of the neck, around the shoulder and upper part of the arm. A fluid blood-colored serum, which had flowed under the neck to the right shoulder, the pavement sloping in that direction. Man, the body was quite warm. No death stiffening had taken place. She must have been dead most likely within the half hour. We looked for superficial bruises and saw none. No blood on the skin of the abdomen or secretion of any kind on the thighs. No spurting of blood on the bricks or pavement around. No marks of blood below the middle of the body. Several buttons were found in the clot of blood after the body was removed. There was no blood on the front of the clothes. There was no traces of recent connection. Okay, so he killed her before he started slashing. He had to have, with there not being any blood like around a lot of places. Especially on the front of her clothes. She had to have been dead before he cut her. Otherwise, that would be physically impossible. When the body...
he's done that before, right? He did that.
Yeah, he did that with the first Nichols. One, didn't he?
Yeah, Nichols, yeah.
Yeah, but then the other two... There was a lot of blood.
Second one, there was blood.
The second one, there was blood. Yeah.
With Chapman, yeah.
I wonder if he prefers the bloodless part, because I mean, I would, given the fact that he's going to have to be quick, because you know, you kill him by slashing the throat, you're going to get blood and shit all over you. So I would right. assume.
I mean, I think you got two things, right? Like one, what you're alluding to there is like, obviously he's got to escape, right? So he can't be covered in blood.
Right.
But then two, I'm thinking if he does fall into some of the beliefs that he might be a medical person, right? Mm-hmm. If he really is just interested in removing organs and doing surgeries and things, if that's his main goal, then he might not be really concerned with the violence of the killing at all.
That's true. That's very true. Moving forward with that theory, which means he probably would prefer a easier choking death.
Yeah. But not to give him any advice, and he's no longer with us, so it wouldn't matter. But it feels like if that was true, though, he would have been better off kidnapping these people and taking his time doing whatever he needed to do.
Well, he might have been caught doing that because I doubt he lived in Whitechapel.
Yeah.
So.
That's true.
And I would say that the people who are renting these beds and boarding houses are probably the people who live there.
Right.
And
yeah.
I can't imagine Whitechapel being a place on the map that would be good for vacationing.
Right.
Yeah. So I think it's probably a lot more risky for him to kidnap them. And then he has to worry about disposing of the body, because you know he's not going to do it where he lives.
Right. It's easier for him to just leave him where he finds him and get out. Right. And I agree with you that he probably doesn't live there for multiple reasons. One, he seems to be someone that would have like
upper means.
Yeah. Because he's out there probably paying all of them initially. I mean, he obviously could get his money back, but we know that he's left Pence on the ground, right? So mm-hmm. he's not even taking the money half the time. He's not taking anything from anybody.
Yeah.
But another thing is if he randomly stayed at some of these lodging houses, like say it got late and he's like, I'm gonna stay at this lodging house tonight, because I did that, he would probably more likely have been caught, right? So he's got to be exiting the whole area like almost immediately. And
he would have to, because you know he has to have some blood on him if he's hacking into these people,
right? And we know that the lodging houses were the first places that the police looked for potential suspects and didn't find any there.
Yeah, so I don't get it. Yeah, he is. I'm not saying this as a fan or anything, but he was a brilliant guy. He really was. And total ballsy guy.
Yeah, I mean, he had the perfect amount of intelligence plus a time period that really was conducive to what he was doing. So like we've discussed before, forensics sucked, right?
Yeah.
Fingerprints was a new science, right? So even fingerprints weren't, you know, and if somehow he left hair follicles or blood, none of that would have even really mattered.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. So it's a perfect time period. And realistically too, though, you would think, I mean, he is doing the crimes in a manner that doesn't produce a lot of blood for the most part, other than clearly the last murder and the second. Right. But he's always described from all of the people that have been suspected as having a coat, right?
Mm-hmm.
You always could put your coat on the ground, kill the person, and if there's minimal blood, then you just put your coat back on and you go home, right?
Yeah, that's true. Because, I mean, these coats were long and loose.
Right, long, dark trenches, and they tie in the front or button, and you could cover yourself up pretty well.
Absolutely.
And it seems like he always is described with a hat, so you keep your you remove your hat and coat, put them back on. All you have to really do is make sure your face and hands are somewhat presentable.
Or just hidden in your jacket, I guess.
Yeah, your hands can go in your pockets, right? As long as your face isn't drenched in blood, you're good.
Yeah. And I can't see why there would be any reason for it to be drenched in blood, because there would be no arterial spurting because they're dead by the time he's hacking into them. Right. So it's, yeah, this guy was too good. Too good. All right. When the body arrived at Golden Lane, some of the blood was dispersed through the removal of the body to the mortuary. The clothes were taken off carefully from the body. A piece of deceased's ear dropped from the clothing. Oh, Lord. I made a post-mortem examination at 2:30 on Sunday afternoon. Rigor mortis was well marked, body not quite cold. Green discoloration over the abdomen. After washing the left hand carefully, a bruise the size of a sixpence, recent and red, was discovered on the back of the left hand between the thumb and first finger. A few small bruises on the right shin of older date. The hands and arms were bronzed. No bruises on the scalp, the back of the body, or the elbows. The face was very much mutilated. Actually, I'm going to go back to that for a minute. So the bruise on her hand. I wonder if he had tried to hit her when going in, if she put her hand up as like an evasive blocking
type defensive thing. Wound type yeah. thing. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's possible, or it's also it's possible she struck him too, right?
Oh, that's probably, yeah, yeah. I hope she did. I hope she got a good smack in on him.
Or it's possible she hit it on the ground falling.
True. I like the she hit him version better, though. So yeah. I'm going to go with that one. Girl power. The face was very much mutilated. There was a cut about 1/4 inch high through the lower left eyelid, dividing the structures completely through. God. The upper eyelid on that side, there was a scratch through the skin on the upper left eyelid near to the angle of the nose. The right eyelid was cut through to about 1/2 inch. There was a deep cut over the bridge of the nose extending from the left border of the nasal bone down near the angle of the jaw on the right side of the cheek. The cut went into the bone and divided all the structures of the cheek except the mucous membrane of the mouth. I tell you what, missing that, you know, not getting to finish on the first one, he was certainly making very up angry. For it with the second one.
Yeah, I would imagine he was in a state of rage at that point. Oh,
he had to have been. The tip of the nose was quite detached by an oblique cut from the bottom of the nasal bone to where the wings of the nose join onto the face. A cut from this divided the upper lip and extended through the substance of the gum over the right upper lateral incisor tooth. About 1/2 inch from the top of the nose was another oblique cut. There was a cut on the right angle of the mouth as if the cut of a point of a knife. The cut extended 1.5 inches parallel with the lower lip. There was on each side of a cheek a cut which peeled up the skin, forming a triangular flap about 1.5 inches. On the left cheek, there were 2 abrasions of the epithelium under the left ear. The throat was cut across to the extent of about 6 or 7 inches. Good Lord. A superficial cut commenced about 1.5 inches below the lobe below and about 2.5 inches behind the left ear and extended across the throat to about 3 inches below the lobe of the right ear. Man, he was super knife happy.
Yeah. God. I think it's amazing that with all this cutting,
yeah,
they said earlier that there was no superficial bruising.
I know. I mean,
how is it possible that she's just not all...
Well, you're talking super, super sharp knife.
Yeah.
For it not to leave, you know... Right. Well, not to mention, too, she's dead, so there's not going to be that...
Right.
You know, pulling of blood and everything. But yeah, God, he's likes his knife. We're like only halfway through. This is horrible. The big muscle across the throat was divided through on the left side. The large vessels on the left side of the neck were severed. The larynx was severed below the vocal cord. All the deep structures were severed to the bone, the knife marking intervertebral cartilages. The sheath of the vessels on the right side was just opened. The carotid artery had a fine hole opening. The internal jugular vein was opened about 1.5 inches, not divided. The blood vessels contained clots. All these injuries were performed by a sharp instrument like a knife and pointed. The cause of death was hemorrhage from the left common carotid artery. The death was immediate and the mutilations were inflicted after death. That doesn't make any sense to me, because if she was killed by her artery being cut, that would be blood spurting all over the place.
Yeah.
Unless he knocked her out and Well, that, okay, yeah, I don't understand that, because unless you just like take a little pinpoint prick and nick the artery so it opens, but that would not, that wouldn't be an immediate death, because she'd have to have time to bleed out. So that is interesting. I wonder if he had something
like a tourniquet.
No, because if he, you can't really tourniquet that. Well, I mean, you still would have to bleed out.
Yeah.
Unless he had some kind of a cloth or something to catch the spurting blood that he just took with him. That is a very, very interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Any medical doctors out there listening, if you can explain this to me, I would be greatly appreciative, because I can't come up with any way that an immediate death with the common carotid artery being cut would not produce blood spurting everywhere. That's going to bug me now. We examined the abdomen. The front walls were laid open from the breastbones to the pubes. The cut commenced opposite the ensiform cartilage. The incision went upwards, not penetrating the skin that was over the sternum. It then divided the ensiform cartilage. The knife must have cut obliquely at the expense of that cartilage. Excuse me. Behind this, the liver was stabbed as if by the point of a sharp instrument. Below this was another incision into the liver of about 2.5 inches. And below this, the left lobe of the liver was slit through by a vertical cut. Two cuts were shown by a jagging of the skin on the left side. God. The abdominal walls were divided in the middle line to within 1/4 inch of the navel. The cut then took a horizontal course for 2.5 inches towards the right side. It then divided around the navel on the left side and made a parallel incision to the former horizontal incision, leaving the navel on a tongue of skin. Attached to the navel was 2.5 inches of the lower part of the rectus muscle on the left side of the abdomen. The incision then took an oblique direction to the right and was shelving. The incision went down the right side of the vagina and rectum for 1/2 inch behind the rectum. That's a, God, he's got to be moving her and stuff like that to get these incisions.
Yeah, and he's got to have a lot of time, I would think.
That, or he's just really, really good at what he does. God. Because that's a lot of incisions. He's pretty much cutting her entire body open. There was a stab of about 1 inch on the left groin. This was done by a pointed instrument. Below this was a cut of 3 inches going through all tissues, making a wound of the peritoneum about the same extent. 1 inch below the crease of the thigh was a cut extending from the anterior spine of the ilium obliquely down the inner side of the left thigh and separating the left labium, forming a flap of skin up to the groin. The left rectus muscle was not detached. Surprised.
Yeah, he left something intact. Wow.
Yeah, right. There was a flap of skin formed by the right thigh attaching to the right labium and extending up to the spine of the ilium. The muscles on the right side inserted into a frontal ligaments were cut through. It's like he was completely dissecting her. I mean, yeah. Absolutely.
Right. That's why I was thinking it feels a lot like a medical doctor, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Or somebody who's just like insanely curious about, hey, I wonder what the inside of a body of every
part I wanna looks know. Like. Right. I mean, I know as far as like at least Tumblety was concerned, there's still question as to whether or not he was a certified doctor. Right. You know, I mean, some of these people might be insane self-made doctors, right? Back in that time period.
Oh God. The skin was retracted through the hole of the cut through the abdomen, but the vessels were not clotted, nor had there been any appreciable bleeding from the vessels. I draw the conclusion that the act was made after death, and there would not have been much blood on the murderer. The cut was made by someone on the right side of the body, kneeling below the middle of the body.
Okay.
I removed the content of the stomach and placed it in a jar for further examination. There seemed very little in it in the way of food or fluid, but from the cut in, partly digested, farinaceous food escaped. I'm not sure what that is. Food. I have to look that up. The intestines had been detached to a large extent from the mesentery. About 2 feet of the colon was cut away. The sigmoid flexure was invaginated into the rectum very tightly. Ooh, Lord. Right kidney was pale.
Farinaceous. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Farinaceous is just a food consisting of starch.
Oh, gosh. So maybe like potato.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. The intestines had been detached to a large extent from the mesentery. About 2 feet of the colon was cut away. Right kidney was pale, bloodless, with slight congestion of the base of the pyramids. There was a cut from the upper part of the slit on the undersurface of the liver to the left side, and another cut at right angles to this, which were about 1.5 inches deep and 2.5 inches long. Liver itself was healthy. The gallbladder contained bile, of course. The pancreas was cut, but not through, on the left side of the spinal column. 3.5 inches of the lower border of the spleen by 0.5 inch was attached only to the peritoneum. The peritoneal lining was cut through on the left side and the left kidney carefully taken out and removed. Okay.
And we had talked about that earlier, right? That's
spoiler
alert. That will end up in Scotland Yard, not because they find it, but because the Ripper sends it to the police because he taunts them. And that's the kind of mentality we're dealing with here.
He's just awesome like that. He gives presents. Mm-mm-mm. The left renal artery was cut through. I would say that someone who knew the position of the kidney must have done it. Again, alluding to medical expertise.
Right, right. And we were talking about it off taping, but you know, we're going to get to where the uterus is taken out here too. Mm-hmm. But the kidney he sends to Scotland Yard, right? But right. This is the second time that a uterus is taken, which to me, again, kind of points to when they were talking about how there was some medical doctor in town looking for uteruses. And now we've got the second uterus taken. So it kind of gives some credence to that theory.
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with you on that. And I think, you know, with somebody needing a very small, specific part of the human anatomy like that, I don't think a butcher is going to be able to do it. I don't think they have enough knowledge of the human body to be able to do that. Medical student, medical doctor, you're not going to convince me otherwise.
Like we said, it could be someone that's not necessarily certified, but they've been chopping up people for a long time, way before the first victim, right?
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true. So yeah, okay. Let me amend that to someone who has a vast knowledge of the anatomical
human anatomy. Yeah,
absolutely. And we're still not done with his report. No. Okay, so let's jump back into it. Okay, where the hell was I? The lining over the uterus was cut. The womb was cut through horizontally, leaving a stump of 3/4 inch. The rest of the womb had been taken away with some of the ligaments. The vagina and cervix of the womb were uninjured. That's interesting. The bladder was healthy and uninjured and contained 3 or 4 ounces of water. There was a tongue-like cut through the anterior wall of the abdominal aorta. Now that would cause some severe bleeding. The other organs were healthy. There were no indications of connection. I believe the wound in the throat was first inflicted. I believe she must have been lying on the ground. The wounds on the face and abdomen proved that they were inflicted by a sharp pointed knife and that in the abdomen by 1/6 inches or longer. The wounds on the face and abdomen proved that they were inflicted by a sharp pointed knife and that in the abdomen by 1/6 inches or longer. I believe their perpetrator of the act must have had considerable knowledge of the position of the organs in the abdominal cavity and the way of removing them. It required a great deal of medical knowledge to have removed the kidney and to know where it was placed. The parts removed would be of no use for any professional purpose. I think the perpetrator of this act had sufficient time or he would not have nicked the lower eyelids. It would take at least 5 minutes. I cannot assign any reason for the parts being taken away. I feel sure that there was no struggle and believed it was the act of one person. The throat had been so instantly severed that no noise could have been emitted. I should not expect much blood to have been found on the person who had inflicted these wounds. The wounds could not have been self-inflicted. I'm sorry, but I disagree with that. My attention was called to the apron, particularly the corner of the apron with a string attached.
You disagree about the blood, right? Not the, the self-inflicted. Blood, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I disagree about him not being covered with blood, if arteries. Yeah. Unless he was just out of the way. But again,
it's very, very, very rare, I would think, that someone does very in-depth surgery on themselves.
Right. Yeah. That would be especially, you know, cutting your carotid. But again, there would be blood all over the place. But, you know, okay. Yeah. Anyway, one thing that I don't think was clear, because it kind of, he kind of used cutting around and cut through like the uterus, which we had mentioned earlier, he did take the uterus with him on this one. And it wasn't, the doctor didn't specifically spell it out. He kind of just minced words as he was talking about how it was actually cut out. My attention was called to the apron, particularly the corner of the apron with a string attached. The blood spots were of recent origin. I have seen the portion of an apron produced by Dr. Phillips and stated to have been found in Goulston Street. It is impossible to say that it is human blood on the apron. I fitted the piece of apron, which had a new piece of material on it, which had evidently been sewn onto the piece I have, the seams of the borders of the two actually corresponding. Some blood and apparently fecal matter was found on the portion that was found in Goulston Street.
Yeah, again,
thus just ends his gory report.
Yeah, just again, though, to reiterate how horrible the forensics were back then. It is impossible to determine whether the blood is human or animal.
Yeah.
Thank God we don't live in that world anymore, or no one would ever figure out who killed anybody.
No, no. Yeah. Short of someone confessing. Yeah. Oh. All I can say is that I am so glad she was dead before all this started happening. Because you talk about torture. But he's not about torture, because he puts them out of their misery quickly.
Right.
Well, most of them anyway, before he really, you know, but I mean, even cutting her throat while she's alive, the second one, it's not obviously an immediate death like they portray in the movies. It may take a minute or two, but you know,
yeah,
it's still pretty quick.
But it you feel like with all the cutting, it's like a rage, like I had said, like he's making up for the last one and he's in this rage, but he seems very intentional about what he's doing. He seems like he's taking parts that he wants, and then he's cutting random shit too to make it look like it's for murder. Not that it's not murder, but I think he's taking things that he needs, and then he's making it look like it could be any random person.
I mean, yeah, that could be. Definitely could be, because, I mean, he seems, I think he's a very intelligent guy. I also kind of wonder if it's just that rage coming out in him. Because, I mean, this was pretty explicit. The next one we're going to talk about next week was even worse. Yeah. It was the worst of all. So
he was in the most seclusion at that point, right? So he's able to do exactly what he wants. That's like the fruition of his gig.
Yeah, that's the pinnacle of his killings.
Yes.
Well, that we know of anyway. Worded.
Not the fruition of his gig. Whatever you said was better. Yes.
I was reading the thesaurus today. Just kidding.
Nice.
You gotta either just be really pissed off or just someone who doesn't have any feelings towards a human being whatsoever. I don't know.
After this victim, though, it's really weird to say, because they all are deceased. But the other victims were lucky so far, right?
Yeah, and that's saying a lot.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. After next week, she might be saying she was pretty damn lucky too.
Yeah.
So be prepared for an even more graphic one next week, kiddies. Now, on to the poor, pitiful funeral. Catherine Eddowes was buried on Monday, October 8th, 1888. She was buried in an unmarked grave in an elm coffin in the City of London Cemetery. So, like the other ones, except for, who was it that actually has a tomb? Was it Annie? I think. Yeah, it was Annie, right? The last one we did. Yeah? This is how awesome our memories are, people.
Yeah.
So today, Square 318 has been reused for part of the Memorial Gardens for Cremated Remains. And this is where Kate was originally buried. Kate lies beside the gardenway in front of Memorial Bed 1849. In late 1996, the cemetery authorities decided to mark Kate's grave with a plaque. So she got one of those little circular plaques, just like the first two did.
Yeah, so, it was Elizabeth Stride, by the way. That was
Yes, Elizabeth Stride. That's right. Thank you. Well, I mean, it kind of looks like they know where she is, at least, in the cemetery. So that's a good thing. But the first two poor things, they're somewhere there. So at the time of her murder, she had a black straw bonnet trimmed in green and black velvet with black beads, black strings, worn tied to the head, black cloth jacket trimmed around the collar and cuffs with imitation fur, and around the pockets in black silk braid and fur, large metal buttons, dark green chintz skirt, three flounces, brown button on waistband. The skirt is patterned with Michaelmas daisies and golden lilies, man's white vest, matching buttons down front. Okay. Brown Lindsay bodice, black velvet collar with brown buttons down front, gray stuff petticoat with white waistband, very old green alpaca shirt worn as undergarment, very old ragged blue skirt with red flounces, light twill lining worn as an undergarment, white calico chemise, no drawers or stays, pair of men's lace-up boots, mohair laces, right boot repaired with red thread. God, they're specific.
Yeah.
One piece of red gauze silk worn as a neckerchief, one large white pocket handkerchief, one large white cotton handkerchief with red and white bird's eye border, two unbleached calico pockets, tape strings, one blue striped bed ticking pocket, brown ribbed knee stockings darned at the feet with white cotton. And her possessions were two small blue bags made of bed ticking, two short black clay pipes, one tin box containing tea, one tin box containing sugar, one tin matchbox empty, 12 pieces white rag, some slightly bloodstained. Okay. One coarse linen white, one piece of blue and white shirting, three-cornered, one piece red flannel with pins and needles, six pieces soap, one small
stop on the comb. 6 pieces of soap real quick. Like, I mean, I was like with some of the other stuff too, but 6 pieces, it's just really kind of illustrates what I was saying last week about how these women kind of carry everything they own with them, right? This is like, why would you have randomly 6 pieces of soap, right? You're taking everything.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, she had knives and hemps and aprons. I mean, she had, I like this one. Mustard tin containing two pawn tickets, one in the name of Emily Beryl, 52 White's Road, dated August 31st, 9 pence. That's what I'm going to say, 90. So I'm going with 9 pence for a man's flannel shirt. The other is in the name of Jane Kelly of 6 Dorset Street and dated September 28th. Oh, we have a new one here. 2S. John, I need to know what S stands for. 2S for a pair of men's boots. Both addresses are false. Printed handbill, portion of a pair of spectacles, one red mitten. One red mitten. Okay. So she was missing a mitten.
She's got one mitten. She's got half a glasses. Like, man.
Oh, maybe it was like one of those monocles. She was going for the monocle look, like Mr. Peanut. But yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, well, they technically didn't have a home, so they would have to bring all their possessions with them. So,
right, but you had talked about it before about like where they keep the clothes, and I said maybe they live out of like a bag. So it's like, but when we're talking about what she's wearing an excessive amount of stuff. It's almost like she's got everything on.
Maybe it's cold.
Yeah, it's possible too.
She might be layering up like that, or again, you know, maybe she just didn't have enough room in her, you know, bags to put all that stuff in.
Yeah.
But then you think about that too. She's got all that shit on. He has to get that off of her. That takes time too. How in the hell is this guy doing it?
You've got to get through like layers to start cutting on these women.
Yeah, she's got like 100 layers on right now.
It hasn't really specified if he's cutting through their clothes or if he's removing them.
He would have to remove them for the shit that he's doing, especially on her.
You would think. Or he's got to just disintegrate them, just cut them to pieces.
Yeah, I would, if I had to guess, I would say he would have to. Well, I mean, I don't recall any of the reports saying, you know, they were naked though, right?
No.
Hmm. Well, that makes him cut her that so much better. That
it's like she almost have to be.
Well, I mean, and a lot of his cuts are so specific. I can't imagine him doing it through layers of clothing.
Right. And the photograph you have of her here, she's naked, but that's probably from the corner, right? That wouldn't be how they found her, probably.
No, that's the stuff that he was describing. That those are the incisions. Right. Like, so if it was a corner she would have like a, there would be two other cuts, like collarbone down to sternum, to kind of open her up. But I mean, that's exactly the line. I am working on a website for us, so I will post these pictures on there. I'm not going to put them on Instagram because they're, this one in particular is a bit, you know, much, I think, too. We might get banned if we put it on Instagram to show people. So once I get our website up and running, I'll get everything posted underneath episodes so you can go back and see it. But it's pretty gruesome. I mean,
a rough one for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That and the next one is as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's an interesting thing. Layers, and he was, yeah, I'm going to go with he had to at least split her, you know, clothes down the middle, maybe part them or some way.
Yeah, because he's not redressing them. That's too much nonsense time, right? You wouldn't waste your time doing that.
Right.
I mean, the past ones, you know, for the most part, they just had their skirts hitched up and the surgery stayed low. But here he's cutting everywhere.
Oh, yeah. There's not a part of her body that hasn't been touched.
He's getting her eyelids and everything. I mean, there's clearly no clothes over your eyelids, but he's from head to toe doing something.
That just, God, I want to know what his pathology is so bad. Because, I mean, that's, why do you want to slice somebody's eyelids open like that? That's just, I don't know. It's so crazy.
Yeah. I feel like he wanted the organs for a specific reason because he does have some sort of background. But that he didn't anticipate that he would like it, right? The rest of like the eyelids and things like that, he's doing for his own pleasure.
Yeah, that would make sense. I can see that. Mm-mm-mm.
All right, guys, I guess that will be all for Catherine Eddowes. Thank you guys for joining us. As always, I am Ben.
And I am Mandy. And once again, if you like us, please subscribe, share our podcast, give us a rating, give us a 5-star rating. That would be fantastic.
Tell your friends.
Yeah, tell all your friends, because we would love to have as many people listening as possible. Because come on, let's face it, who doesn't love true crime, especially stuff like this?
Yeah.
And if you want to get in touch with us, our email is throughtheabysspodcast@gmail.com. We are also on Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat at abysspodcast1. Thanks for listening as always, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Well, Ben, we got another episode under our belts. Thanks so much for tuning in to Through the Abyss podcast. And until next time, keep it weird.
Spooky stuff.